Welcome to the podcast of this Brecan information session. Information sessions are recorded at the Brecan Resource Centre and can be borrowed in CD format from the Resource Library. Sessions are copyrighted and are for personal home use only. If you would like to know more about this and other sessions, please contact Brecan on 1300 781 500. We hope you enjoy this podcast.
This session was recorded on the 5th of August 2015 at the Olivia Newton-John Cancer and Wellness Centre in Melbourne in conjunction with Brecan. Professor Jonathan Seebon, Director of Medical Oncology at the Austin Hospital and Head of the Cancer Immunobiology Program for the Ludwig Institute for Cancer Research, has been conducting research into ways in which the immune system may impact on cancer cells. In this session, Professor Seebon will talk about the link between the immune system and cancer, immunotherapy, and the current research being undertaken to develop new treatments that target cancer cells. We hope you find this session interesting.
Do I speak in the microphone? I thought my vote. Welcome. I hope the trek out to Heidelberg wasn't too much of an imposition, but we're delighted to be able to host you out here. We're very proud of the centre that we've built. And one of our major areas of interest is the immune therapy of cancer. And so this relationship between the immune system of cancer is something that people have been interested in a long time, and it's now really having impact in terms of the way we treat cancer. So that's what I'll be talking about today. So this is a cover, now more than a year old, from one of the top journals in the world, scientific journals in the world, Science. And you've heard of Science, you've heard of Nature. They're really the peak journals in terms of scientific discovery. And they described cancer immunotherapy as the breakthrough of the year in 2013. So this is no longer something which is on the fringes of cancer treatment. This is now mainstream. It's now got the attention of the scientific community. And that's because it's having impact on the lives of people with cancer. It's because it's now reached prime time. So it's not some little area of scientific, it's not a curiosity anymore. It's mainstream. And it took a fair while to become mainstream. As far as back as, the 1960s, our own Nobel Prize winner, McFarlane Burnett, proposed this concept of the immune surveillance of cancer. That the immune system could recognize cancer, that little tumors or cancer cells probably arose in the body all the time, and that the immune system went around seeking out those abnormal cancer cells and destroying them, and that this was something that was part of everyday biology, and that cancer occurred when this immune surveillance broke down. And that really stayed a theory for many years. It captured popular appeal. There were a lot of people in the community who sort of recognized this or believed that it was probably the case, but it actually took more than half a century for the scientific establishment to finally recognize that this was very much the case. And so he was really the person who opened our eyes to this as a proposal, but the scientific proof took some time to catch up with it. So let me go through some of the evidence that has accumulated over the years, which now tells us how right Sir McFarlane Burnett was, back in the 1960s. So this, many of you will recognize as a kidney, but it's not an ordinary colored kidney, it's a black kidney. And the reason it's black is because it's full of melanoma cells. So how did that kidney get to be full of melanoma cells? So melanoma, as many of you will know, is a form of skin cancer. It's a skin cancer of pigment cells, and melanoma tumors are often black. So the presence of black tumor cells within this kidney is very abnormal. And the story that accompanies this picture is that the kidney came out of someone who had a kidney transplant. So this wasn't their own kidney, this was someone else's kidney that was implanted in them. And it was implanted in them because they had kidney failure and they needed a substitute kidney. And when that kidney went in, it looked a perfectly healthy kidney. There was nothing apparently wrong with it. But it failed, it stopped working, and so the surgeons took it out again, And when they took it out, as you can see, it was black. And they went back into the history of the person who donated that kidney. And they went back 16 years. And 16 years earlier, that patient had had a melanoma removed. Had been perfectly well at the time that kidney was donated. There was no evidence that the melanoma was there. But there must have been melanoma cells in the kidney because they started to grow and ultimately grew back and the kidney failed. And the regrowth of those melanoma cells happened under very unique circumstances. And the circumstances under which that happened was that the patient who received the kidney had their immune system suppressed. And that's the point, that when the immune system isn't working properly, stuff which may have been under control for 16 years can break out again. And that was certainly the case in this instance. You know, there was no evidence. So clearly in the body of the donor, that immune system had completely controlled the melanoma. It wasn't apparent to anyone. And only under the circumstance of the suppression of the immune system did the cancer start to grow again and become apparent. So there's one example. Now the other example I'd like to tell you about is a patient who is a patient of this hospital. She's actually alive and well. And I first met her in 1998, actually 99. So I met her 16 years ago, almost to the day actually. So it was in about July. And she had this disease called Crohn's disease, which is a disease of the immune system, which involves inflammation of the bowel, but that had been in the past. She was completely well. It had never come back again. It was in remission, so that wasn't an active problem. Then in 1998, someone found a melanoma on her tummy, and she had that removed. And it had a whole lot of bad features about it. And in fact, just a year later, in 1999, it relapsed. And then it turned up in her brain, which was, and that little brain tumour was treated with some form of radiation. And then it turned up in her liver. And there's a scan that shows a nodule in her liver. That's a liver tumour there. And she also turned up with disease in all sorts of other places. And in fact, at about this time, her Crohn's disease flared up. Little by little, all of the tumour deposits in her body, in her skin, in her liver, everywhere else, just disappeared. We didn't treat her, didn't do anything. It just went away by itself. And that happened at the same time. Can you hear me? Sorry. That happened at the same time as her Crohn's disease flared up. So there was this relationship between this autoimmune process, this inflammation involving the bowel, and the disappearance of her cancer cells. And in fact, we studied her in some detail and found this relationship between the immune system being activated on the one hand and the cancer going away on the other. And here's just another little example of something that we removed. This is melanoma. Or at least a mass that was removed from her tummy, from her gallbladder, and the black cells there that you can see are the dead corpses of melanoma cells. This is melanin, which is the pigment cell, the pigment that comes from melanoma, that sits inside cells called macrophages. The macrophages are the cells of the body that go around and clean up after a tissue has died or been killed. They're the scavenger cells of the body, and they're stuffed with black pigment, which is the melanin. So this was evidence of the body's immune system mopping up. And in fact, there were no live melanoma cells there. They were all dead melanoma cells, and they've been scavenged by these scavenger cells of the body. And I've updated the slide since now. I was just here a couple of months ago. She's alive and well, no evidence of disease. So this interesting relationship, immune system activation with some Crohn's disease on the one hand and the disappearance of a cancer happening on the other. So the third piece of evidence that there's something that links the immune system with the control of cancer, and all of these examples are in melanoma, but as you'll see later on, this is not just about melanoma. It just so happens that melanoma is the disease that I see the most of. So, my best examples are drawn from melanoma, but this relates to other cancer types as well. So all cancers have got stage. Stage one is usually an early stage disease, often cured with surgery. Stage two is a little bit more advanced. By the time you get to stage four, that usually means you've got disease which is far advanced, and many patients with stage four cancer face a situation where the disease is not cured with existing treatments, although that's now changing. If you look at this is called a survival curve. And the way a survival curve works is you start up here. So this at the, on the bottom is zero. That means that's time zero. And then each one of these is 1 year. So 1 year, 2 years, 3 years, out to 15 years. And each of these lines starts at the top, which means everybody's alive. And then people die. And over time, the curve drops because there's people who disappear from out of that group of patients. Okay, so for stage one disease, you can see that the majority of patients are still alive 15 years later. Whereas if you've got stage four disease, the back, if you can't see the front screen, there's some screens at the side there as well, you can see that many of these patients die within the first 2 or 3 years. But in fact, there's some patients who are still alive. Maybe 10% of patients are still alive out 10 and 15 years later. So what is it that distinguishes someone who's had stage 4 melanoma, who's alive 10 or 15 years later, from someone over here who dies of melanoma, you know, within 1 or 2 years? Is it because the cancer is fundamentally different, or is there something else that's going on? Well, if you look in the cancers of these patients who are long-term survivors, and here's some pictures shown here, you can see that inside the cancer there are often these things, which in this particular picture are stained brown, and these are cells of the immune system, what we call T lymphocytes or killer T cells. And these are the cells of the immune system that are responsible for going around and they kill viruses and they can kill cancer cells. And these are the cells that McFarlane Burnett was interested in, or which in fact no one knew about T cells back in his day. They were discovered later. But in fact, you know, his proposal was that the immune system was able to go around and recognize and scavenge and kill. And these brown things are the killer cells of the immune system. And if you've got a cancer which has got more of them in the cancer, and the pathologist can look in it and see, in the case of melanoma, you're far more likely to survive long term, even if you've got stage 4 disease, compared to people whose tumours don't have those cells. So it's indirect, but it's sort of another piece of evidence, piece in the puzzle, that says the presence of an active immune system makes a difference in terms of how you survive your cancer. So, in summary, stage 4 melanoma, that was the patient, Mrs. R, who I told you had secondary tumours in her brain, her liver, bones, skin. Normally, you'd expect her to survive about 7 months based on this, okay? But she wasn't one who survived 7 months. She was someone who's actually alive here 14 years later, 15 years later. So she's well and truly out on this part of the curve. And in her case, the big thing that we saw was that her immune system was activated, as evidenced by her Crohn's disease. And the discussion for today is, all right, this happened spontaneously. This, if you like, was an experiment of nature. Can we as doctors harness whatever happened in her case? Can we harness that and use that to treat cancer so that patients who would normally be on this part of the survival curve can end up out here alive and well 10 or 15 years later? And the answer to that is yes, but not always. And the reason the answer is yes is because of the stories that I'm going to tell you now that relate to some new treatment approaches to cancer based on new understandings of the immune system. So the beautiful thing about science is that it continually evolves. What McFarlane Burnett knew in 1967 was new then. What we know now is a whole lot more. And what we now know is not only that the immune system can do it, but we know a lot about the things that regulate the way the immune system works. And once you know how the machine works, then you can tinker with it. And the molecules which are important here are the molecules that regulate the immune system, and therefore if we tinker with them, we can manipulate the way the immune system works. So I'm going to tell you about two molecules. One, and they got dreadful names, okay, and they're not even as dreadful as the names of the drugs that have been used to target them. So the first one is called CTLA-4, and the other is called PD-1. And the drugs, well, here goes, ipilimumab and pembrolizumab, or nivolumab. So there you go. All right, let's talk about these. Okay, so this is, these are some cells of the immune system, and the immune system is made up of cells which do all sorts of things. So these blue ones are the T cells. They're the cells that go around and can do the killing, but they have to be told what to do. They have to be educated, they have to be instructed. They have to be switched on, and at an appropriate time they have to be switched off. If they're not switched on and switched off, then you don't get things started and you can't end the process. And in order for things to work properly, you've got to be able to switch them on and off, okay? The on switch comes over here from this green cell. This is something called a dendritic cell. And dendritic cells are the cells in the body which orchestrate immunity. They're the things that kick things off, that get things started, and help to tell the T cells what they need to recognize and activate them to go and do that. And within this black box, you may or may not be able to see it, there's something called a T cell receptor and some activation molecules. In fact, it's sort of amplified down here, okay? So if you like to think of it this way, this group of molecules here tells the T cell exactly what its target has to be, because the T cell can't go and kill anything. It's got to kill something specific. And the dendritic cell shows it what it has to go and kill. The dendritic cell sits around waiting for viruses and cancers and other things to emerge, and when it finds things that are abnormal in the body, it breaks them up into little bits and presents them to the T cell as an educational process so that the T cell knows what it's got to go after. The dendritic cell also has got some signals here. It's simplified, but it's called an activation signal and an inhibitory signal. In other words, in order for the dendritic cell to do things, it's got to switch things on and switch things off. And there are molecules that do that. Okay? So that's here where the immune system gets started. Now, the immune system ends up in the tissues where the T cells have to go and do their killing. And just as you need to start and stop things at the commencement phase, likewise at the completion phase, you can't have this thing going on in an uncontrolled fashion. So within the tissues, there are mechanisms for switching things off. So the important molecules to know about are, as I said, CTLA-4 and PD-1. What CTLA-4 does is that's something which switches things off or puts the brakes on during that initiation phase. And what PD-1 does is it puts the brakes on or slows things down out here in the tissues. Okay? And cancer cells have often got PD-1 on them. So cancer cells have got their own ability to switch off the immune system. This off switch wasn't developed as something for the cancer to use, but cancer, if you like, has hijacked it. And cancer is able to utilize this mechanism to avoid killing by the immune system, if that makes any sense. So to put this into a sort of a simplified form that is easily recognizable, you can't start your car without putting a key in the lock, right? So the key is specific for the car. If you don't have the right key, you can't get started. And so to get the immune system going, for that immune cell to recognize the right thing, you've got to have the right key, right? But starting the car is not enough. You've got to have accelerator and brakes. CTLA-4, as I mentioned, is a bit like the brakes, okay? And if you put your foot on the brakes, it slows the immune system down. And if you take this drug that I mentioned to you before, ipilimumab, what it does is it interferes with this braking mechanism. So it's like taking your foot off the brakes. If you take the foot off the brakes, away the immune system goes, okay? So that's how it works. So this is what it looks like in real life. So this is from a patient who I saw in clinic just this week. Although these scans were taken about a year ago, this is, you probably recognize this, this is his guts, and there's his heart up there, and this is his liver, and this big football-shaped size thing in his liver is a great big massive tumor, okay? And he was given ipilimumab, something that blocked CTLA-4, that took the brakes off his immune system, and 3 months later, or a little bit more, 4 months later, this is what was left of the cancer, okay? You can see how much his immune system has attacked
that cancer. A little bit left still, but most of that tumour has been destroyed by these T lymphocytes, these killer cells of the immune system. Okay, now the other one is PD-1, and there's a drug that we use to block PD-1, and this is an example of someone who had secondaries in their lung. So these are tumours sitting in the tissue of the lung, so that's his heart, so that's meant to be there. That's his backbone, that's meant to be there as well. This is his chest wall, but these round things here are not meant to be there. Those are secondary tumours in the lungs, and you can see this is September 13, this is April 14, so this about 6 months later, and you can see that that these have all completely disappeared. Okay, so that's another immune check, what we call an immune checkpoint. So this is a drug that interferes with the immune system. So those are examples of individual patients. So what does it look like in a clinical trial? So this is a clinical trial in which colleague, this is a trial actually we also ran here at the Austin, it's now published in the scientific literature, took these two molecules together, anti-CTLA-4, ipilimumab, and anti-PD-1, nivolumab, and combined them. And I'll show you what happened. So these aren't pictures of patient scans, but each one of these lines represents an individual patient. So we can just track these patients one by one, okay? So this, again, this is time, so each one of these marks is 10 weeks, so this goes out to about 120 weeks, and this is an individual patient, and you can see in this case the tumour grew, okay, so that combination of treatment, the drugs did nothing for this individual. But he's a sort of the exception, or she, really. I mean, in this case, the thing grew for a bit, but then, you know, sort of flattened out. Here it grew for a bit and then stopped, and all the rest of them, the thing either stopped growing or shrunk. And for many of these patients, you can see within the first 10 to 20 weeks, the tumour started at, you know, at this point and pretty much disappeared. And when it gets down to minus 100, that means 100% of the tumour is completely gone. So you can see that for many of these people, the cancer has disappeared altogether. And that's shown in this graph here. So again, each one of these lines is an individual patient. And it shows, you know, minus 100%, which means the tumour's gone, disappeared by 100%, increased by 100% means it's doubled in size. And you can see that this point here is about maybe a quarter of the way along. So three quarters of these patients benefited from the treatment. About a half of them had complete disappearance of their cancers. About another third had something that was less than complete disappearance, but, you know, significant shrinkage. And about a quarter to a third had growth of their tumours. So the vast majority of these patients benefited from this treatment. Now this is melanoma, okay? When I started practicing, melanoma looked like... Like this, okay? Any patient who walked through the door, I could expect that about half of them would be dead within 7 or 8 months. And... nearly all would be dead within 2 or 3 years, and a lucky 10% would be alive out at 5 or 10 years. Now this is the situation, okay? We're seeing that in response to this treatment, the vast majority of them get disappearance of their tumour, and many of them get shrinkage of the cancer. And if you look at the survival curve, and this is actually a little bit old now, it's been updated, and with longer follow-up, it's, you know, it's still looking pretty good, but perhaps not quite as good as this. But you can see that this is the survival of these patients. It's not hovering down here at the 10% mark. You can see it's hovering up here at the 70 or 80% mark. So in the case of this disease, it's really transformed the outcome for patients. And whereas 5 or 10 years ago, the vast majority of patients could expect to die from their disease, now, if people don't survive their disease, they have every reason to feel that they've been cheated. You know, that the majority of patients are now getting benefit from this form of treatment. So it's completely transformed the disease. So your BRCAN, so although you're interested in seeing how things go in melanoma, what you really want to know about is what about other cancers as well, including breast cancer and ovarian cancer and other cancers that are of relevance. So the story in other cancers is an evolving one. It's still early days, and I think there's good cause for hope. But whether or not the same sort of excitement that we've seen in melanoma ends up being the case in other cancers is not so clear. But let me tell you, give you a little bit of information that helps you to sort of think about it, okay? So this is some information about patients who've had transplants, okay? So all of these numbers relate to numbers of patients, and these are people who've had kidney transplants. So as a result of the kidney transplants, their immune systems have been very heavily suppressed, and as a result of having heavily suppressed immune systems, they have developed cancers. Now, not everyone who has a transplant develops cancer, far from it, most don't, but you do have an increased likelihood of cancer when your immune system is suppressed after something like a kidney transplant. And if you look at the numbers, you can see the ratio of what... So the risk ratio refers to what the probability is, or the likelihood is, or the numbers are in someone who's had a transplant compared to the normal population. And the highest ratio, you know, 1,000 to 1, is this thing called CNS lymphoma. Now, the reason that's so high is because you hardly ever see this disease in the normal population. It's an extremely rare cancer, which means that if you do see it in a transplant population, it's a much higher probability, right? So some of these, the numbers are high because they're otherwise very rare cancers. So don't pay so much attention to the numbers. If you go down the list, though, you can see that there's many cancer types, which are not just melanoma, in which the risk ratio is higher if you have a transplant. And you can see that includes bladder cancer and kidney cancer and lymphoma and liver cancer and bowel cancer. So, you know, for common cancer like bowel cancer, 2 to 1. Breast cancer, interestingly, the likelihood of getting breast cancer if you've had a kidney transplant is no higher than if you've a member of the, you know, normal population without immunosuppression. So there's not a really strong signal coming through from the transplant literature in relation to breast cancer. Now, that doesn't mean that breast cancer can't be treated with immunotherapy. It just means that if you look at it through this sort of analysis at the effects of suppressing the immune system, you don't see all that much breast cancer compared to normal. It's no worse than usual. The point to make, though, is that there's lots and lots of different sorts of cancers here. So it's clear that the immune system isn't just about melanoma. It's, you know, there's lots of different cancers which are affected by immunity on the basis of this sort of evidence. And if you then look at, okay, these drugs, ipilimumab and pembrolizumab and nivolumab, if you look at the data that's come out of clinical trials and ask yourself what sorts of cancers are responding to these, is it just melanoma? The answer is no. So melanoma is on the top of the list. I showed you that if you combine two of these drugs, it can get up to about 80% responses. If you look at inhibiting PD-1 with just a single antibody, depending on which clinical trial you look at, it's anything up to about 40%. And then lung cancer and kidney cancer and bladder cancer and down the list. Okay, so there's a lot of different types of cancer that respond to PD-1 inhibition, and on the list you'll see triple negative breast cancer. Now, triple negative breast cancer, as some of you will know, is one of the tough to treat breast cancers. Many cancers will respond to Herceptin and to tamoxifen and Arimidex and letrozole and all sorts of hormonal manipulations, and you know, you can get some benefit from chemotherapy. But the one type of breast cancer which, you know, is the tough one to treat and tends not to do well despite a lot of the treatments that are available out there for breast cancer, is triple negative breast cancer. Now, triple negative breast cancer, not all, but many of them do respond to PD-1 inhibitors. So there's a glimmer of hope in terms of breast cancer. And interestingly, in that type of breast cancer that has proven to be, in many ways, the most problematic of the breast cancer types. And then other cancer types like mesothelioma and liver cancer. And then some other cancers which are relatively uncommon, which are forms of bowel cancer, which turn out to be responsive. And in here, there are some gynecological cancers as well, in particular some types, subgroups of ovarian cancer and endometrial cancer. So these clinical trials reflect work that's been done in patient populations within just the last 2 or 3 years. This is all very, very new. And what we will see happening is there'll be more and more clinical trials with these immune-stimulating agents as single agents and then in combination. And as the combinations are built, the responses will increase, and as the responses increase, we'll find that we can get more and more benefit in more and more patient types. And the work to be done is going to be to figure out how to combine these agents and to increase the numbers that benefit from this form of treatment. And I don't think it's going to replace chemotherapy across the board, but in some instances it may well replace chemotherapy. I don't think it's going to help everyone across the board, but certainly there will be some types of cancers which currently don't respond to immune therapies which will respond. And as the clinical trials get done and as the scientists work away in the laboratories, we'll figure out how to improve the likelihood of benefit and how to improve the numbers of patients who can be treated with this form of treatment. So that's the main part of the talk, just in terms of what I've got to say, and I'm very open to questions. But I just think that the important points to come out of this are that cancer does respond to immune attack, and this is now mainstream cancer medicine. It sits alongside surgery and radiation and chemotherapy. Immune therapy is now the fourth pillar that holds up the edifice, and probably, and you know, in many ways, you know, a really more exciting one than some of the old ones. We haven't talked about side effects, but yeah, it does come with some side effects, and we can discuss that at question time. The important thing is that this has come out of science. It hasn't come out of wishful thinking. It's come because researchers have figured out how the immune system works over many years, and that science is now being applied in a rational way in clinical trials. And these clinical trials are still underway. The trial process is really just starting, and these treatments are going to have a significant effect, not just in melanoma, but other cancer types as well. So I think I might leave it at that, and take questions. Thank you. So the question at the back, if you didn't hear it, is: do you have to stay on these treatments forever or not? So there's a couple of points. The first thing is there are other treatments for melanoma. There's things called BRAF inhibitors, which are also available for about 40% of people with melanoma, but they don't work on the immune system. They work in a different way. With the immune therapies, there are two main forms currently being used in melanoma: the anti-CTLA-4 drugs and the anti-PD-1 drugs. The clinical trials with anti-CTLA-4 involved treating patients on four separate occasions. So the patient would receive an injection, and then 3 weeks later would get another injection, and that would happen four times, and then it would stop. And so all of the clinical trials are based upon just 12 weeks of treatment. Okay. With anti-PD-1, the clinical trials have involved 2 years of treatment. And so the standard of care is 2 years. Now, I think with time we'll figure out whether you really need to be on it for 2 years or whether less than 2 years is satisfactory. And, you know, it's still something that is being worked out. No one really knows whether or not that full 2 years is necessary, or whether longer might be helpful in some situations, or whether less might be helpful in some situations. There are certainly examples of patients who've had to stop early, usually because of side effects, where the drug's been stopped and they've stayed well and haven't needed, you know, the disease has gone away and it's never come back again. But the interesting thing about those patients is they've usually come off because of severe side effects. And the side effects are the side effects of having a hyperactive or a souped-up immune system. So they're probably the patients whose immune systems have really gone into overdrive. And it may be that they've done so well because the drug was particularly strong in those cases. So we're still working a lot of that out. But at the moment, the way it goes is anti-CTLA-4 or ipilimumab, it's four doses over about a 12-week period. And for the anti-PD-1 drugs, it's 2 years of treatment. Well, so it's still early days. And so when people have come off after 2 years, most of the patients remain well. But some patients are running into strife afterwards.
but not everyone. So it's a variable picture. And because it's so early in the piece, we don't really know what the long-term results are. You know, it'll be another 5 years before we can answer some of those questions. Yeah, so chemotherapy works very differently. Interestingly, there's some evidence that some forms of chemotherapy can work by stimulating the immune system, believe it or not, and that's because within the immune system there are some cells called regulatory cells or suppressor cells. So these are cells of the immune system which suppress immunity, and if you can selectively kill them off, you can actually boost immunity. So there's ways of giving chemotherapy which will actually, believe it or not, enhance the way the immune system functions. I think the way it will play out over time is based on the results of the evidence that comes from clinical trials. So there are some diseases. Now let's take an example, say lymphoma, or what we call germ cell tumours, which are very, very highly sensitive to chemotherapy, and where chemotherapy can often cure the disease. Okay, so the current state of the art is that chemotherapy will result in a cure. It's going to be very difficult to do a clinical trial with something new if the existing treatment can cure the disease, because you've got to better that. You've got to do better than that. So melanoma was a good place to start because the existing treatment didn't help anyone, right? So you did a clinical trial. It was easy to introduce the immunotherapy. You go into a disease where your existing treatment provides a curative option. You've got to be very careful how you design that clinical trial, because you don't want to result in harming the patient by denying them something which is curative. So there's always this challenge of being able to design a clinical trial where you're comparing it with the state of the art. And the better effect that the state of the art has, the more difficult it's going to be to displace it. So for those treatments which are already readily cured with chemotherapy, and there are some types of cancers which are very, very sensitive to chemotherapy, it's going to be difficult to nudge it aside. Okay, for those diseases, and breast cancer is one of them, I think, where you know chemotherapy often helps somewhat, but may not be curative, then you've got a better chance. But you've still got to demonstrate that what you're offering is more likely to be helpful than your existing standard of care. And so the clinical trials will establish that. And if in patients, for instance, with triple negative breast cancer where chemo is not, you know, all that effective, are able to benefit from immunotherapy, then you can design a trial to demonstrate that. Getting a demonstration that immunotherapy helps in common or garden breast cancer is more challenging, because the signal of activity of the immunotherapy at this stage is not all that strong. So you haven't got a good basis to go in and say, you know, we can displace chemo through a clinical trial process. So, but that people will work on that, and the clinical trials will yield the results. In terms of steroids, it's true. Corticosteroids given for long periods of time in high doses are immunosuppressive, and we generally avoid them in patients who are getting immune therapies. However, it is still possible to give steroids in some situations to patients getting immune therapies without that compromising the benefit. And sometimes we have to do that, especially if they get side effects, because the side effects involve often the immune system being overactivated, and to try to bring that under control, we do need to use drugs like corticosteroids to dampen down the side effects. So there is a balance there, and sometimes cortisone or corticosteroids are needed to be used. Yeah, so I didn't quite catch the first question. Yeah, so the blood diseases are on a spectrum, and there are some forms which are readily responsive to chemo and can often be cured, and some forms of lymphoma fall into that category. There are other forms of blood diseases, other forms of lymphoma and leukemia, where treatment can often be successful but is not curative. So there's a whole spectrum, and there are some forms which don't respond very well at all. So it depends a little bit on what type of lymphoma and what type of leukemia it is that you're specifically referring to in terms of what the response rate is. And that applies whether you're talking about chemo or whether you're talking about immunotherapy as well. Now, in terms of immunotherapy, the emerging evidence in lymphoma is very fresh, and so the story is
evolving, but there's no doubt at all that there are some forms of lymphoma which are highly responsive to immune therapies, in particular PD-1 inhibitors, and that includes both Hodgkin's and non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, but not across the board. So, you know, there's a classification, there are different sorts of lymphoma and different sorts of, even within Hodgkin's disease, there's different forms of Hodgkin's disease. And the clinical trial shows that some of those have got high levels of something called PD-L1, and those tumours that have got high levels of PD-L1 will often respond to anti-PD-1 therapy. But it's very early days. You know, the first clinical trials in lymphoma are only just now starting to be reported. And, you know, even in terms of clinical trials, I mean, I think there's, in Australia, to my knowledge, there's only one clinical trial at the moment open in non-Hodgkin's lymphoma with a PD-1 inhibitor, which is open here at the moment, but or about to open here. But, you know, it's still very early days. They might, I don't. But I could probably find out. Yes, so ovarian cancer is on the list there. So clinical trials have, you know, depending a little bit on the selection of patients, have shown up to a 20% response rate. Again, you know, ovarian cancer, there are different forms of ovarian cancer, and I think what will happen over time is that we'll identify the responsive ones and not. This is just to single drug PD-1 inhibition. I think what will happen over time is that, you know, in ovarian cancer as well, we'll start to figure out that, you know, you need to use combinations. So, now in terms of systemic lupus, the point that you raised there I think is an important one, and that is that an overactive immune system can sometimes be a cause of disease and distress and illness in some people, and it can even kill you. You know, autoimmune disease can be very serious. What we're playing with here is something which activates the immune system, and the side effect of these drugs is that you activate the immune system, and patients who are on these drugs are at risk of having autoimmunity as a side effect. So one of the autoimmune side effects that people with ipilimumab get, for instance, is inflammatory bowel disease. Just like I showed you the example of that lady who had Crohn's disease, in fact, a side effect of the drug can be that you can get colitis, the bowel can become inflamed. What it's meant is that when patients have been recruited onto clinical trials, usually the clinical trials have excluded people who've got known autoimmune disease, because, you know, the surest way of killing off a treatment is to cause serious side effects. And so trials have rules, and one of the rules is you include some people and you exclude others, and generally people with autoimmunity were excluded from those clinical trials. That has meant that there's very little hands-on experience with these drugs in patients with autoimmune disease, so often the information is not available. There's a little bit trickling through now that the drugs are becoming more widely available and people are being treated off of clinical trials. We've got, you know, that fellow that I showed you with the big liver, in fact, got a little bit of rheumatoid arthritis, and his rheumatoid does get worse when he's on the immunotherapy. But, you know, if you've got to die of cancer on the one hand or suffer from sore joints on the other, you know, that's an easy choice. But for something like lupus, which could be life-threatening because of its effects on the brain or the kidney and so on, you know, it's a more difficult decision. And so often it's a question of weighing up the risks. And we've, to my knowledge, never treated anyone here with lupus. But someone will walk through the door at some stage who's got a serious, you know, history of lupus, who, you know, is faced with the difficult decision of whether or not to, you know, to go ahead with a form of treatment that might make them. Yeah, so you'll see that lung is second on the list up here. So there's been a lot of clinical trials that have shown that lung cancers do respond. Again, it's not 100%, you know, it's 10, 20, 30. Yeah, so combining them. Yeah, so the TKIs are often helpful, and the immune therapies are often helpful. And as people build the combinations, what's going to happen? So if you look at, and the problem is, of course, for everyone, especially those with family or with cancer themselves, you know, the progress is never fast enough, right? If you look at the history of chemotherapy, you know, back in the 1940s, it started off with single drugs, you know, nitrogen mustard, mustine, you know, and then little by little, people figured out how to start to combine them. But it took, in a couple of generations, to get those combinations to the point where they'd been sort of figured out to be the best combinations.
it won't take that long with immunotherapies. And for diseases like melanoma and lung cancer, where TKIs work and where the immunotherapies work, the obvious thing to do is to bring them together. At the moment, what tends to happen is people have the one first, and then when that fails, they go on to the next thing. But the clinical trials are now being done, which bring them together, and we will see over the next 2 or 3 years clinical trials which combine immune therapies with TKIs. But the trials are only just being designed and performed now. There's no results through yet. So there are things like Oncotype DX and other tests which look at the genetic makeup of the... But what those tests do is they often help to direct people or to predict outcomes based on the current state of the art, and that's usually got to do with, you know, responses to hormonal therapy and chemotherapy and so on. So that those tests are used as tools to assist to guide the outcome in terms of, you know, treatment decision making. For the immune therapies, the things that determine whether or not the cancer is going to respond will be different to the things that determine whether or not the cancer will respond to, say, a hormone therapy. So let's just take, for example, estrogen receptors or progesterone receptors. You know, those are predictive tests for responses to drugs like, you know, Arimidex or tamoxifen. You know, if you're receptor positive, you're more likely to respond to a hormonal manipulation. So the test has some predictive value in the context of that form of treatment. The things that are useful in terms of predicting response to an immune therapy will not be things like the hormone receptor status or the presence or absence of HER2. They're going to be things that relate more to the way the immune system is regulated. So I mentioned these molecules, CTLA-4 and PD-1. Molecules like that and molecules that relate to the way the immune system is regulated appear to be the things that help to predict the likelihood of getting benefit from an immune therapy. So and the earliest results of that are only just reaching the scientific literature now. And the results don't... So we don't necessarily know in all cancer types. There's certainly information in melanoma and lung cancer, and probably stomach cancer and head and neck cancer, so a few of the cancer types. And what the predictive test that helps to identify the patients who are more likely to respond to an immune therapy relate to whether or not there's evidence within the tumour that the immune system has already been activated. So a signature that says, all right, there's immunity happening here. The immune system has engaged with this tumour and the immune system has gotten started. Now, something is blocking it from working properly, but nonetheless, it's trying. And when you then go in with these things that then boost that, you can get that attempt from the immune system to have an effect into something that actually works. But if the cancer is an immune graveyard, if you look into that cancer and you just don't see any evidence that the immune system is engaged, then in those circumstances, these treatments don't appear to be very effective. And so that becomes the challenge. How do you convert that tumour from an immune graveyard into something where the immune system is starting to take hold? So they're both really good questions. So the first thing is that the site of the secondary tumour does appear to have some impact. So in melanoma, and this just applies in melanoma, secondaries in the lung seem to be much more likely to respond than secondaries in the brain or the liver. The brain is a site where you're less likely to see an immune response working. Having said that, there are still examples of patients out there who've had secondaries in the brain where it has worked. So it's not black and white, but certainly in some organs, the immune system does seem to be better able to do its job than in others, and that's probably got to do with the different tissues of the body can withstand inflammation to a different extent. The brain is a place where you don't want too much inflammation going on because, you know, that's bad news generally. So now, in terms of the second question, at the moment, whether or not
the immune system has been activated in the tumour, is that a go or a no-go in terms of the treatment? Again, it depends a little bit on the type of cancer. So in lung cancer, the current clinical trials require, for a PD-1 inhibitor, a lot of the clinical trials, I'll say, you need to have something in the tumour called PD-L1. PD-L1 is something which activates PD-1 on the T cells, and if you don't have PD-L1 in the tumour, you're far less likely to respond. And so at the moment, the way the clinical trials are designed, if you don't have that on your tumour, you're not eligible for the drug. But that rule doesn't apply in other cancer types. For example, in melanoma, that's not a restriction. So it does vary from cancer type to cancer type. And that's largely, built up around the likelihood of benefit. So the feeling is that if the chances of getting benefit are very slim, then it's not fair to put patient on a trial in the hope that they might benefit from it if, we know from experience that the chances of that benefit are tiny. So, but it does vary from trial to trial and cancer type to cancer type. Yeah. So it depends how much later. Okay, so if you're talking a few days later, it doesn't make any difference. If you're talking some months later, it does make a difference. Okay, so this trial involved giving the IPI or the Yervoy pretty much simultaneously with the PD-1 inhibitor. And you can see, the responses there are very high. In the very first trials that were done with PD-1 inhibitors in melanoma, a lot of the patients had failed Yervoy, so in a sense they'd had Yervoy previously and then went on to a PD-1 inhibitor, but months or years later, and the responses there were much lower, 80% to, maybe 30%, so, big difference. Not to my knowledge, but my knowledge is limited. Sjögren's disease is an autoimmune disease which involves the salivary glands and other glands which produce body fluids, right? And it's associated with, as I recall, I've got to go back to my student days, that there are some forms of lymphoma that can sometimes emerge in patients who've had Sjögren's disease long term, I believe. I'd need to double check on that, but I know of no link between breast cancer and Sjögren's disease. So I think if you know of someone who's got both conditions, it's probably bad luck rather than a recognised link between the two. Yeah, I don't know. So with IVF treatments, there's often a lot of hormonal manipulation that's done in order to stimulate ovulation and to enable, the harvesting of ova and so on. And that plays havoc with people's bodies. I think anyone who's been through the process, will attest to that. Now, the extent to which that can increase the risk of cancer, I just don't know. It's very difficult to comment on individual cases, of course. I mean, there are lots and lots of people who go through IVF successfully. Yeah, that sounds like good advice. Yeah. So the question is, do these immune therapies attack normal cells as well as cancer cells? Yeah. So the side effects that we see with these treatments vary from individual to individual. The commonest side effect is skin rash, then probably diarrhea, which is associated with bowel inflammation. In some patients, less commonly, you can see the thyroid gland or the pituitary gland getting inflamed. And then down the list of likelihood, inflammation involving the lung, something called pneumonitis. In people who've got pre-existing liver disease, you can sometimes get what's called autoimmune hepatitis. So all of those reflect the immune system, not just hitting the cancer, but also hitting normal tissues of the body. In the case of rash, skin cells. In the case of colitis, bowel cells, and so on. So absolutely. Mostly they do, and that's actually one of the, if you stop the drug, the rash goes away and the colitis settles down and, the hepatitis settles. So the normal tissues of the body, of course, are continually turning over, And if you've got a side effect which involves autoimmunity, you suppress the immune system as required, and usually the normal tissues will recover. So the side effects are usually manageable and self-limiting, and generally can be managed just like we manage the side effects of drugs, you know, through the treatment of other diseases. So you've always got to weigh up the potential for harm against the potential for benefit. You can do liver function tests regularly. It's a blood test, and if you can if you find evidence that liver function is, you know, affected, you can always stop the treatment or give steroids. So, you know, if someone's facing a a serious and life-challenging situation with their cancer, you've got to weigh up whether or not you think the risks of the treatment are going to be worse than the, you know, than the benefits. And in every instance, it's often a question for clinical judgment. Depends on the type of cancer, how bad it is. What, you know, there's lots of things that have got to be weighed up. Great question. So the concern is that our immune systems can probably control cancer, and then that fails, and we get cancer. And you know, what can we do to keep our immune systems healthy to prevent that from happening? So the bottom line is that I don't think there's any simple answer. Okay, but there's no doubt that looking after your physical, emotional, spiritual, psychological health, you know, in broad terms, is important. You know, diet, what you expose yourself to in terms of ultraviolet radiation from the sun, carcinogens from tobacco, you know, all that stuff contributes in some way. It's hard to know. Some of it we know really does make a difference. Tobacco smoke, you know, it's pretty clear. Lying out in the sun is, you know, pretty well established as being harmful. Other stuff, you know, the quality of the proof is less clear, right? So how much impact does diet have? Well, there's no doubt that if you go around the world and look at different populations that have different diets on a cultural basis, you see different patterns of cancer. You know, we've got a very high incidence of colon cancer and bowel cancer in the Western societies that eat large amounts of animal fat as part of their diet, you know, protein from meat and dairy and animal fat, and there's probably a relationship there. You go to places like Japan and China, they're not spared, you know, but have different cancer types, often, you know, upper gastrointestinal cancers and hepatoma, liver cancer, and that's because of the presence of hepatitis B virus and certain carcinogens in the food that's eaten. So, you know, there are lots of ways that we can look after ourselves, but none of them are going to guarantee that we can prevent cancer. But on the whole, I think you just try to keep it sensible. There's not a lot of evidence that pursuing stuff in a faddish way can, you know, or will make a big difference. So, you know, there's a lot of faddism out there, you know, which where people sort of promote extreme practices as a means of trying to prevent or cure cancer, and I think, you know, the evidence is that often that's built on anecdotes rather than on a body of evidence. So, you know, when you look at this stuff, you know, this is a clinical trial with 80 patients, and so you can say with confidence if 53 patients are alive after 36 months, you know, you can say that's a body of evidence built on a research program. Now, if someone says that they tried this diet of scorpions and, you know, spinach and their cancer went away, that's, you know, one case. You don't really know whether that means that everyone that eats scorpions and spinach is going to get better. So, look, I think that what's becoming clear is that the science is delivering. So, you know, there's science, and then there's a bit of pseudoscience out there, and then there's outright sort of, you know, I don't know, there's quackery. There's a whole spectrum of stuff, you know. And so long as conventional medicine and conventional science wasn't able to deliver, then that gave oxygen to people who were peddling nonsense, right? But as we're now starting to get results with, you know, scientific approaches, it means that we're in a much better position to compete with people who've got optimistic stories based on thin evidence.
So two drugs, both ipilimumab and pembrolizumab, are approved by the federal government, by the TGA, and have reimbursement on the PBS, which means that if you meet the criteria, you can receive those drugs at the taxpayer's expense. And more will follow. But combinations, not yet. They're still only available through clinical trials. And there are strict rules around them. So even though they're available in melanoma, for example, they're not available in lung cancer yet. You know, so, but it's evolving. Every month that passes, you know, it changes, actually.
We hope you enjoyed this podcast. You can subscribe to Brecan's podcasts or browse existing ones at our website, www.brecan.org.au.